Hello, welcome Love to Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Create Your Bliss, Transformational Coaching with Nika Annan. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Alan Questel. And I met Alan originally in New York as a Feldenkrais practitioner, and I learned some amazing things about listening to my body there that transformed how I lived my life. So I'm really delighted to have Alan here to share this information with you. He's known for his clarity, creativity, and down-to-earth style of teaching. He brings a depth of understanding, humor, and gentle human perspective to the learning of the method of Feldenkrais, which he'll explain to you, and creates lively conditions for learning. One of his great interests is the embodiment of creativity, and he has developed a body of work for performers utilizing the Feldenkrais method. He sees it as a means for individual maturation and aspires towards making this appreciable and concrete for his students in both the training programs and his practice. He was trained by Dr. Feldenkrais. He's lectured and taught at hospitals, colleges, and the Feldenkrais professional training programs throughout the United States, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, with a lot of countries in there, Japan, and Canada, teaching people from all walks of life. So I'd like to welcome Alan Questel, and I think we'll start with talking about what is Feldenkrais.
Well, first, Nika, I'd like to thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here and seeing you in this context, which is really different. And so what is Feldenkrais? This is a question that people struggle with all the time because the name right away, sort of people go, what's that? Does it mean? So, well, it's a man's name. It was developed by an Israeli physicist named Moshe Feldenkrais. And he was actually someone who was he was a real Renaissance man. He was one of the first Westerners to get a black belt in judo. He was a mathematician, physicist, avid athlete. And as an athlete, he destroyed his knees playing soccer. And some days one knee would hurt, some days the other knee, some days both knees, and some days neither knee. And he thought, what am I doing different? And he started applying the ideas of physics to his human functioning and reading more anatomy, physiology, creating a lot of ideas about our neurology and how we work, and actually developed this whole method. Of course, he healed his knees in the process, although he had bad knees till the day he died, but he could do what he wanted to do. And that's one of the underlying tenets in the Feldenkrais method, is that it's a movement technique, and there's two modalities in it. I'll explain both of them. But we use movement to improve functioning, to reduce pain, to improve neurological conditions. And the range of people that use it go all the way from brain-damaged children to professional athletes. And the funny thing is, what I do with a kid with cerebral palsy or someone with a stroke or a professional athlete or professional dancer is really the same thing, which is I'm helping movement translate more through their skeleton. So when we talk about movement, people often get an idea that there's a correct way to move and we're going to learn that. And actually, in Feldenkrais, we don't teach that. What we're looking to do is to teach more choice in how we move. So depending on the context you're in, you might act one way or in another way. And the second major thing that we're looking to do is to evoke a more skeletal use of ourself. What does that mean? So the skeleton is the part of ourselves that bears weight and transmits force. And we tend to underuse that and overuse our musculature to do those things. So what happens in Feldenkrais is a kind of gentle deconstruction of our muscular habits to the point where we reside more fully in our skeleton. And the results are, as I said, improved functioning, reduction of pain, improved abilities, things of that sort. And it's done in two different ways. And the way that Feldenkrais first developed was called functional integration, which I always laugh at because it sounds like such a, that sounds serious, you know.
And put your body back together.
Really what we're doing is we're synthesizing an action in a different way. And so that's a hands-on process where I, as a practitioner and another practitioner, is using what they see and primarily what they feel to lead you to a different use of yourself, okay? And they're very small, gentle movements. And then Moshe thought, that was Moshe Feldenkrais, by the way, he thought, well, you know, there's just so many people I can work with in a day. So he thought, well, how could I work with more people? And he created another process called awareness through movement, which is taught in classes. And there's classes all over the world that people can do and many things online, CDs, tapes, things like that. And these are gentle movement sequences that people are led through that, again, affect changes in posture, range of motion, reduction of pain, a change in self-image, which is a big part of it as well. And of course, you know, the Feldenkrais method, a training program in it is 4 years. So when someone asks me, what's the Feldenkrais method, this is like the short spiel. The longer one is 4 years.
That's so wonderful. So as I understand it, Feldenkrais really involves a lot of learning and changing habits. And this is the element I find really exciting about Feldenkrais, because I found it worked for a tool that I could translate into other parts of my life. It's what am I learning here? How can I do this in a way that works better, that feels better, that allows me to do more of what I want to do, what I'm trying to do? So I was hoping you could talk to, which I just heard about. I didn't know you had a book until 5 minutes ago, or maybe that was 10 minutes ago. But I'd like for you to talk about your book, because I'm really interested. I mean, I love Feldenkrais. I've done it off and on my whole life. But I've also found that I use it a lot in different modalities. I do a trance group with people, and some of the trance postures are difficult to hold. So I just say to people, we'll do the Feldenkrais thing. You do it in your mind. You hold the image of your body in that posture, and you don't have the physical pain, and you have the same effect on your body. So I guess that's a lot of questions in one there.
Yeah, there's a few questions embedded in there. So I'll start with the first thing that you brought up, which was about learning. And this was actually the basis that Moshe was investigating in terms of how our nervous system functions. And he proposed a lot of ideas about how our nervous system functions way back in the 40s, and most of them have been realized today is true, that's really what's happening. Yeah, he was quite ahead of his time. And he was interested in what he called organic learning, which is an innate sense of learning that all of us have. Like you see a kid crawling around, moving towards something, but then it gets interested in something else, and people think, oh, the kid has a short attention span. But, yeah, it's true that their attention spans aren't that long, but they're also very much engaged in the process of what they're doing. And when we talk about, for example, working with people with pain or neurological conditions, they tend to function in the realm of a diagnostic model, which is different than a learning model. A diagnostic model is one where they tell you what's wrong, they can name it, and then it can tell you how it's going to progress or not progress, and it's often not a positive thing, and these are the only things you can do. Whereas in learning, it's open up to a lot of different ideas. So when I work with someone, I'm thinking of not just the physical condition that they may come with, but also their thinking and their feeling as well. So the whole person. And then we're then dealing with the realm of self-image, which is a big thing as well. And now I'm losing my thread here because you asked me so many questions.
So that was about learning and how we learn. And then the other thing is, okay, wait.
So there's one other thing about learning. And this is something that's kind of embedded in the Feldenkrais method, which is pretty important, because especially as we get to the idea of creativity, okay? And that is that there's the idea of learning. And, you know, when I teach the idea of learning, what I like to do is ask people what they think learning is. And I like to write everything down. And I don't like to eliminate any idea or any way of doing it. And I'm really not interested in creating a definition of learning, that I think it's a dynamic process that's going to change depending on the context and the people participating. But then there's another aspect to it, which is learning how to learn. And when I ask people the question, so we've talked about learning, what's learning how to learn? And that's a hard one to wrap our heads around. And basically, it's the kind of unconscious strategies that we've all created in any learning context. So whatever, and sometimes it's conscious, like, oh, I can't learn language or I can't learn math. So we've created a belief system around something like that. But even in other cases where we think we're good learners, we do the same things, like we sit close to the teacher or we sit at the back of the room. Or we have internal conversations like, I'm going to be the best one at this, or I'll never get this, or everyone's better than me. And that's kind of the foundation that needs to be interfaced with and interrupted for different kinds of learning to take place, because otherwise we do the same things over and over and over again. And that's where our life or the things we do become a little mundane, or we feel plateaued on things, and we're not getting the kind of juice of things that we go, I want to feel more vitality and more interest in things. And often, if we try to change how we've learned how to learn, the context that we live in, our daily life, is too important. So we can't make those changes there. What we can do is we need a context where the context is of relatively no importance. So you're lying on the floor, moving around, bringing your elbow to your knee, your nose to your knee, your forehead to your knee, doing these unusual movements, and then noticing, oh my God, I'm working too hard, or I'm trying to be the best one, and where does this come from? As opposed to just kind of listening to, how am I doing this? And so that's the first step.
Yeah, in how, and really acknowledging. And I know my experience with it is that it re-engages the curiosity and how do things fit together. And that for me, a driving force in my life is curiosity, and that learning is sort of the cutting edge of how else could I do it. And my big message in my head is I have to do it right the first time.
So curiosity is, it's really hard to learn without curiosity. We can, but when someone's curious, they're engaged in the. There is another way of learning that's actually faster, but pain.
I don't like pain.
I know no one likes, but pain at irregular intervals. People learn very fast. When someone's being tortured, their pain is induced at irregular intervals. But the problem with that kind of learning is it becomes so compulsive, necessarily so, mm-hmm. that it's very hard to undo. So people who've been in camps and things like that, it's years and years to undo the trauma that they've felt because the learning is so deeply embedded at a level that they can't reach that it's hard to change. But let's not talk too much about that. We'll talk about curiosity.
Great.
And so curiosity is the thing that, so then the question is, how do you get someone to be curious, right? And people are curious about different things, And, in my book, there's actually one chapter called If I Could Teach You One Thing. And that one thing would be to generate your own internal enthusiasm, right?
Fabulous.
Well, yeah, but it's a little bit of a challenge, isn't it? Many people have their own. Sometimes you meet someone who's got a lot of enthusiasm and you think, oh, I wish I felt that way about the things I was interested in. So then the question is, well, how do we start? And we have to start small with something like that. We can't just expect it to be this big thing because that person didn't start big. That person grew it over their lifetime, and we see it. And part of the continuation of their enthusiasm is that they feel they succeeded at something, so they get more enthusiastic, But the thing that, if we come back to the book and the idea of creativity,
mm-hmm.
okay? So when I was in my Feldenkrais training with Dr. Feldenkrais, it was a four-year program, and in the second year, he was yelling at someone, which was his nature very often, and I thought, this guy's trying to teach us creativity.
Hmm.
And at first I thought it was kind of bold to do that, and then I had enough hubris to write a book on it myself, And I was an actor before I did Feldenkrais, so I think I was engaged in that process to some degree. But then I started to think, well, what does it mean to be creative? Right, and that's a question. If I ask a group of people, if I say, how many people here are creative? Some of them, their hands will shoot up into the air. And some hands will kind of wander up, and some people will just look down at the ground depressed. And I said, well, let me ask another question, okay? So the second question I like to ask is, do you know someone who's creative? Well, everyone raises their hand, right? Because we all know someone who we think is creative. But then I have to ask, well, what's the difference between them and you? How do you view them as being more creative and yourself as not being as creative? What's the difference? And as I've investigated, we can name a lot of things, but I've investigated, in my investigations, I've come up with one simple idea, which I think speaks to the whole process of learning to be more creative, which is someone who I see as more creative sees or makes choices that I don't see. So I'll come into their house and they'll have like a Chinese parasol upside down now as a light fixture on the ceiling. And I'll come in and I'll go, oh, that's so cool. I didn't think of that. So that's creative. But, you know, the person who does that, they don't think they're creative. People who are creative, I mean, if people tell me I'm creative sometimes, and I go, yeah, okay, I guess so, but I don't think about being creative. I think about what do I want to do, which is that's a bigger question, and that's hard to do. So now, if we come back to this idea that someone who's creative is someone who can generate choices, then we're right back to the Feldenkrais method, because what we're interested in is seeing how can we generate more choices and how someone uses themselves. And we use movement as the means to do that.
So why movement? So I'm really curious, because it's about embodying. So because I think moving the body has really deep impact on all those levels you were talking about earlier. So
you know, when Feldenkrais was developing his work, he was looking at the human being, and he said, what goes on in a human being? And in his study, he thought, well, there's thinking, there's feeling on an emotional level, there's sensing, and there's moving or acting in the world. And a change in any one of those aspects of the self potentiates a change in the others. So now, can we change how we think? Yeah, of course we can, you know. But it's a tricky process because it's done through our thinking. So I think I'm thinking differently, right? You know, I mean, so we loop around and trick ourselves sometimes. And I find that when I notice changes in my thinking, it's over time. Does it change quickly? Sometimes. But something dramatic has to be presented to me for my thinking to really change. And I'm not talking about my ideas of whether something's good or bad. I'm talking about how I actually think about things, you know. So it's tricky. And can we change how we feel? Well, yeah, we can do that too. But most people don't know what they're feeling, or they're feeling too much of something. So to go about changing it becomes this thing, and what's a feeling? I can talk about that later if you want. I mean, I have ideas about that. And then, of course, we have our sensing, how we take in and process information. And that's, I mean, if you look at all the ideas of neuroplasticity that exist today, that's like the big buzzword. And if there's a great book called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge. And, you know, but most of that research has been done over a long period of time. It's not brand new research. But you can see it's years and decades of research, right? But then if you look at our movement, it's immediate. If you change how you move, it's in that moment you know you're moving differently or not. So Feldenkrais thought that's the place that I want to interact with the self-image of each person, because it's more immediate and it's much more concrete. You can actually see and feel the difference. When you see someone, can you see someone's thinking differently? No, maybe you hear it in their language or something like that. But how we move really dictates a large part of how we are. And a large part of our nervous system is given over to standing, to moving, to interacting in the world. And if we change that, if we become more skeletal, our brain works differently. Something else is happening. So that's pretty much the reason why movement is the most significant way that, in this case, that we're using it. I wouldn't say the most significant, one of the significant ways that we can change ourselves and do something differently.
Well, that's really exciting, because as you were talking about that, I know one of the things that goes in and out of vogue is the whole discussion of body language and how much of our communication is nonverbal. And now they're talking about how 80 to 85% of the communication between people is nonverbal, which is sort of interesting when you look at virtual connections between people. We seem to be missing rather a lot of information there. But I have found that, well, first of all, I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but there's sort of the running joke about the Feldenkrais buzz after you do a Feldenkrais session, and you experience the world in a very different way, in a sometimes softer and more open way. I think there's a lot of different ways to describe that, but also it changes then. You can change your feelings by changing the way you're interacting with your body is interacting with the world, or you're being aware of your body. And I think that that's also then a source of wellness and perhaps creativity.
So let's talk about what a feeling is for a moment, okay? And then how the Feldenkrais work can influence that. And so I'll describe a situation, okay? So imagine you're in a car, you're the passenger, and the driver is in a complete terrifying rage. They're driving, coming up onto two wheels, they're hitting things, and what are you doing? You're holding on as tight as you can, you're screaming, your pulse is racing, you're sweating, and your heart is beating, and you're terrified, right? So So now imagine this situation. You pay $25 to go on the super roller coaster. And what's happening? You're holding on as tight as you can. You're screaming. You're sweating. Your heart is racing. And you're having the best time of your life. So the physical aspects of it are actually the same thing, but the context is different, so it changes it completely. So I always like to make an argument that a feeling is a complex of sensations within a particular context.
That's really nice. I like the contextual part. Because I feel that that's very important, because how do you interpret your body's telling you?
Through that thinking process.
Yeah. So then the next thing is, well, how do we change that, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if what I'm saying is accurate, then one of the things that we're doing in Feldenkrais is actually practicing sensation outside of any context. So we get to know ourselves better. And so we start to recognize sensations in a more clear way, so that when we are in the world in a particular context and all of a sudden we're experiencing a set of sensations, we often can more clearly know what we're feeling. And I discovered it myself after the first year of my training with Feldenkrais. I was walking from the train to my girlfriend's house, and I used to have a really bad temper when I was younger. Really, I would just boom, fly off the handle in a moment. And I'm walking to her house, and I noticed I was feeling something, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And I realized, I'm feeling angry, and I didn't know it. So somehow the threshold had changed. So it didn't get to the point where the threshold got lowered enough that I could identify something in my sensory world, that I could then act differently as a result of it. And so that becomes an important thing, right? So that becomes something that, because our feelings, you know, if we talk about feelings in the creative process, it's a miserable process if you think about it from an emotional state, because mm-hmm. you go up and down and up and down, you're thrown this way and that way, and what are the means to find the path through it all so you can fulfill your intention? Which is probably one of the other basic ideas in the Feldenkrais method, is how do you fulfill your intention? So think about creating something as fulfilling an intention. So what's the process that you can go through to fulfill that intention? And I know for myself as an actor, one of the things I discovered, whenever I had a role to play, I would get an image of what that role could be like. And I would, in the beginning, I would try to just jump there. And it never worked. You know, I just was always reaching for something that was out of reach. And as I learned and studied some technique, I actually found that I went through this process that I got up to the same level that I had imagined, but not, it was never what I imagined, because that was too fixed. And the process took me somewhere that I couldn't know, right? And so that's often the thing in the creative process, is how do we actualize what we don't know? You know, and that's tricky. Yeah.
Right, so there's that setting the intention and to fulfill an intention, but then you find that the intention is not rigid.
Yeah.
That it becomes a much more contextual, mm-hmm. and I guess I see that as a learning process. As you're getting there, you learn, you explore, you're mm-hmm. curious, and you end up with something that embodies it or actualizes it in a more... in a non-abstract way,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is sort of a contradiction,
yeah, yeah.
you know, that
yeah.
that you actually become it,
yeah.
as
yeah.
opposed to trying to fit into a thought that we've
thunk. A thought that we've thunk, yeah. So but then the question becomes, well, like I said, how do I do it? And in something like awareness through movement, the modality, the class modality I described that you led through, you're led through a series of movements, and most of the time you don't know where they're going to go. You can't predict where it's going to end up, right? Because they're novel movements, they're unusual things. And that's one of the things that the brain really gets stimulated by, is novelty. And so one thing that's happening when we're in that process is, one, like I said, we're exploring sensation outside of our everyday context, so it's not attached to anything. But we're also learning to tolerate being in the unknown more. Because in our culture, we like to know what's going on. You know, the unknown is, there's a lot of lip service given to it, just like there's lip service to given to being process-oriented. People think, yeah, I'm process-oriented as long as I get to the goal, right? And so the question is, if you're really process-oriented, the goal might change dramatically, you know, and that's something that we have to get comfortable doing. And if you, I think most people who are successful in the arts, let's say acting, dancing, music, writing, painting, the suffering part of their existence has been tolerating this feeling of the unknown, right? But at a point, that becomes the interesting part of it as well. So it's something you look forward to. Like when I work with someone privately who's, let's say someone's got some kind of back pain or something, and in the beginning, if the things I did didn't help them or work, I would feel like, oh my God, I feel terrible. You know, what am I going to do? I don't know. I felt lost and sometimes like a deer in the headlight. Then over the years, as I got more experience and I could find more things that worked more of the time, when something didn't work, I went, oh, good. Now I've got to think about this. Now I've got to figure something out, right? And that process of figuring something out is a big part of the creative process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people think of the creativity as being like this inspired state. And it is for a few seconds. You know, people go, oh, I got this great idea. Now I got to make it happen. And that's where all the work comes in. And, you know, all the artists that I know, they talk about the work they have to do, not about that one moment. You know, that's a mistaken idea of what it means to be creative. And so I think at some point when someone's creative, it's just second nature to them, right? And, of course, there's different degrees of creativity that impress us because they think of things that we didn't think of. And we go, wow, that's really cool. How did they do that? But I think every one of us is capable of doing that. You know, and that's the thing that we don't realize is how each person, I see each person as highly creative and has the potential to do something that takes them to a new feeling about themselves.
Yeah, I find that really intriguing and interesting. And I, you know, one of the things that I do as a coach is to try and encourage people to engage that, to have an intention, and then to go through the process and to really savor the process and understand that it really can totally find, amongst other things, your relationship to yourself.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about something that's related in some way, okay, that has been a big interest of mine for a long time. And it came out of a workshop I was developing around self-image. Mm-hmm. And as I looked into self-image, I started to think, without being reductionistic, that it revolved around a pretty simple idea, that our self-image is a reflection of how much I like myself or how much I don't like myself. Mm-hmm. So if I like myself, I have a good self-image. If I don't like myself, I don't have such a great self-image. And then I thought, huh, okay, so then how do I help people like themselves more? And then I actually started to think, after living with this idea for a while, I started to teach it. I thought, this is my job, to help people like themselves more. And like I said, the question is how. So in Feldenkrais, in the classes, the movements that we do are really different than any other modality that I know of. It's different than yoga, tai chi. It's different than any kind of exercise, in that the movements are done really small and really slow. And there's physical laws that tell us why that makes sense, which actually shows that with a decrease in effort, there's an increase in sensitivity. So a smaller movement actually allows us to be more sensitive. So again, if we're coming back to the idea of sensing ourselves, understanding our sensations more, we can feel and sense something in a big movement, but in a smaller movement, we sense more details, and we're closer to the initiation of an action too. And so when we're dealing with self-image, my question is, well, this is a great context to help people like themselves more because they get to practice moving in a way that they like the way it feels, right? And that's tricky. Everyone wants to like themselves more. You know, it's called awareness through movement. But if I went out into the street and I stopped 30 people and I said, would you like more awareness? Some of them would go, yeah. And some would go, huh? I mean, you know, it's just, they're not
interested. Awareness of what?
Well, yeah, they're not interested. And actually, there's some bad news. There's a few things that aren't so great about awareness. One thing is when you become aware, you don't just become aware of the good things. It's like the spotlight of awareness goes on, you see everything. But the really bad news about awareness is that it's irreversible.
It's So what does that mean?
You can't not be aware.
You can't turn it off.
You can't turn it off. Once you can't become ignorant again. Uh-huh. You can go into denial and ignore something, but you can't not be aware. And so that once you start engaging in the process of awareness, it can be daunting at times, you know. But if we come back to the idea of liking ourselves more, this is the thing. When you were talking about learning and helping people fulfill their intentions, part of what helps us do it is that we like ourselves more. And in fact, when we succeed in the things that we want to do, then that sense of liking ourselves more gets even greater, right? And again, it's not a place like, oh, now I like, I've been doing this for years. I'm still learning to like myself more, you know. And it's something that, yeah, I like myself, but it can always be more.
Well, that seems really inspiring and interesting, and, you know, part of my coaching from the Joseph Campbell of Live Your Bliss is how do we create it and how do we recognize it and how do we give ourselves the space and the quiet and the smallness to appreciate and learn to know what it is that we like, that feels good, that gives us pleasure, and then to choose that. And I think that there's another place we haven't really talked about in Feldenkrais and the body and our lives and intention, which is choice. And what does this level of awareness and knowledge do to inform us in how to make choices?
So I think we need to sort of look at the question of what's a choice?
Mm-hmm.
How many variables? When I ask the question, how many variables do you need to have a choice?
Oh, wow.
So, people say two. Well, actually one, because if you have the choice or not have it. So it already implies two. But that's kind of limited. You know, that's part of my definition of depression is when someone has only two choices. They can stay in this bad relationship or they can be alone. They'll stay in the bad relationship. It's more known, you know. Right? So we need a third variable in there. And the minute there's a third variable, it generates movement. So we're back to that idea of movement, that I can go towards something else, moving towards something else. But there needs to be the act of moving towards that thing. Right? It's not enough just to sit there and want something to happen, you know. So, you know, you were talking about working with people and imagining doing some things, right? And in Feldenkrais, often we'll do movements on one side, but then imagine them on the other side. And almost always we'll do it first, so there's some frame of reference, for the imagined part to take place. But I had a guy in a class once, and it really made me so sad when he said it, because we've been talking about imagination and how to do things, and he came up to me one day after class. He said, you know, I've been imagining getting a girlfriend, but it hasn't happened. And I was like, oh, poor guy. He was a lonely guy, you know. And I thought, no, you have to go out and put yourself in a situation to make it happen. It's not just going to happen because you want it to happen. So, again, putting yourself in the situation to make it happen is back into action, back into movement, right? So, you know, the Feldenkrais method, people make fun of it sometimes because it seems so slow, right? But like I said, the slow part, Moshe was very clear about it. He said, in learning, we need to go slow. So in life, boom, we can act quickly. And he was totally, the original title of Awareness Through Movement, I mean, there's different translations of it, but it was generally improving abilities. So he was interested in how do we improve our abilities? How do we do what we want to do? And, you know, it's funny because the process that we explore ourselves in has such a quiet, meditative sense to it that people are like, how does this help me improve what I do? Well, you learn, you know. And you know, when I think of how does someone, what you were saying a moment ago of finding that place to develop oneself in that way, it does take a commitment,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think one of the big things in anything is the regularity in which you do something. You know, when I teach a Feldenkrais training, whatever I teach in the training is only worth what people do with it when they go out and practice. You know, and yeah, that they just did the training and after 4 years said, okay, now I'm a Feldenkrais practitioner, yeah, they could work. But if they practice in between segments throughout the years, their work exponentially becomes more potent in terms of what they can do. So I think, you know the joke about how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, 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 you know. So it's the same thing with everything like that.
So let's tie that back into the body and about making change, because it's not, so yes, we engage our minds and we think, but it's also about, is that training the nervous system? Is that training ourselves to pay attention to the nervous system? What are all the elements in there?
Well,
laugh,
yeah, I love laughing because of nervous system. I'm laughing because, you know, 200 years ago we didn't have a nervous system, but these ideas still existed. And 200 years from now, it'll be called something else, and they'll laugh at us. They'll go, nervous system. They thought they had a nervous system, you know. And Feldenkrais is often described as a neurological event. And then the question I ask is, so what's not a neurological event? We're a nervous system. So, you know, I think for our everyday speaking, it's probably more useful to talk about ourself. How do we tap into ourself? Right, and there are many ways to do it. I don't think Feldenkrais is the only way. I think people can find things through meditation or martial arts or studying something that they like. It doesn't really matter. The question is, how do they bring themselves to it?
Mm-hmm.
So we come back to this idea of learning how to learn,
mm-hmm.
right? And now, most practices that people engage in don't influence that depth or that level of how we interact, learning how to learn. Meditation could, over years,
right.
We're talking about probably 10, 15, 20 years before we realize, now I'm understanding what I do with my mind, where it goes, and the patterns that exist in that, and the habits that exist in that as well, you know. And so how do we change our habits? Well, we need new information to come in. You know, there was an interesting study done with, I think, chimpanzees, and they taught these chimps the scientists would point to an object, and the chimp would point to the written word of the object.
Mm-hmm.
So comb, and the monkey would point to the word comb. Ball, it would point to ball. Glass, it would point to glass. Pen. And they had like a 90% success rate with it. It was remarkable. And then all of a sudden, it started to deteriorate. I mean, poorly.
Mm-hmm.
Where they had like, these monkeys weren't getting it right at all. And they thought, they couldn't figure out what happened. And one day, one of the scientists actually picked up a glass and a pen. And the monkey went, ooh, and he pointed the glass pen really fast.
He got bored.
He was bored. He was bored. It needs novelty. And that's, like you talked about curiosity, or we think of novelty. We need things that bring into our attentional field something that's new. But then if we talk about the nervous system, that's then building new neural pathways, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way. And, of course, you know, like many years ago, they thought our nervous system or our brain was very fixed. Now they're seeing how much more plastic is they could ever have imagined, even into old age, so that we can still do things. But, you know, I was really upset when I read the book, The Brain That Changes Itself, because in it, one of the scientists were talking about, in terms of maintaining our brain or keeping things like Alzheimer's away, it's not enough to hone an existing skill. You have to learn something new, like a language or playing an instrument. And when I read that, I was like, oh, man, I was counting on that. I was really hoping that, you know, honing the skills that I'm good at and getting better at it is something that that'll serve me the end. So now I'm studying Portuguese, so it's a struggle, yeah.
Well, that's interesting because I wonder how different of a context you need to have it be.
Yeah, that's a question.
You know, and I think this is also cutting edge for the scientists who were so busy defining things, which is not a criticism, but just how we've been figuring out science. I remember actually when I first worked with you and we established through movement, I felt a new neural pathway or whatever you call it, mm-hmm. different parts of my nervous or my muscles and
a
new sensation, but there was a connection between my diaphragm and my spine in the middle of a session.
Yeah.
You felt that. I felt it was like, wow, those places didn't know they were connected before,
right.
Which is a really, and it was one of the experiences that I use to reference when I get into situations where I don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, it's really possible to learn things that have been there all along,
right.
But were never included in the awareness,
right. Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, another way I could describe what we're doing with Feldenkrais is kind of coloring in our self-image, right? And so that we start to become aware of things that we didn't know were there before. So another way I would say it is that And it happens more in the private work when I'm working individually with someone, mm-hmm. but it's possible as well in the classwork is too, that how can our blind spots be revealed to us? Mm-hmm. Because the nature of them is that we're blind to them. So we don't even know where to look for them, right? How would you? We don't know what we don't know, right? And so we need either the input from someone else, either through their hands and touch, or through the verbal cues that guide our attention to places in ourselves that normally we wouldn't think of. I can give you an example, okay? I can talk to people who are home listening. So if you're sitting in a chair and you go to get out of the chair, right? And so everyone knows how to stand up and get out of a chair. I mean, there's no big deal about that. So you could try that a couple of times and notice what you notice. And it's so habitual that we don't even notice much. But now the next time you stand up, come out of the chair, can you think of pushing your feet into the ground to stand out of the chair? And most people right away will feel the difference because they're utilizing the ground. And when we utilize the ground, that's when we engage our skeleton more. Now, we're utilizing the ground when we stand in the first case, right? So it's not like now I'm using my skeleton, before I wasn't. But now when I use it intentionally, I start to set up a whole different set of sensations. So I think we all need this input. I don't know anyone who, even the most highly creative people I know, are interested in things in ways that will help them change themselves in some way, generate new ideas, not the ability to look at things differently, you know. And if not, they get bored, right? And they feel like, well, I got to do something else because this isn't fulfilling me in the way that I felt it was before.
So let's talk a little bit about boredom, because I don't understand boredom. I really don't. I mean, I was really fortunate, and I just had an astrological reading, and he said, oh, your sense of security comes from learning and knowledge, which I think is not that common. Maybe it is, but it's not common where I work, let's put it that way. And so I don't know if boredom is not wanting awareness or if it's not knowing. So, yeah, boredom is something I'm curious about because I don't know anything about it.
Well, I think we all know the experience of boredom, you know. I mean, I think most people have felt bored. The question is, how long do you stay in it? But yeah, it's a hard, you know why boredom is hard to explain? It's up there with gravity, because it's an explanatory principle.
Uh-huh.
It describes a phenomena, but where's your boredom? And then where does it go when you get unbored, right? It's just from one moment to the next, you're bored and then you're not bored. So, but I think one thing we can say when we're bored is that we don't have a place to put our attention. And so If we're directed, if our attention can be directed in different ways, we can get engaged again. If you think about playing with a kid, and a kid is starting to get ready, they seem bored, and you think, you give them something to do, right? You engage them in some way that makes them interested in something again. It's like those monkeys, they got bored, you know? They were like, there was no reason for it to do it. So, I mean, I've looked at this myself too, because I've had people sometimes in a class say, I'm bored, and I think, well, what does that mean? But for me, what I get interested in is what's underneath that, what they're feeling,
right?
And I often find that when someone's bored, they're scared,
mm-hmm.
in some way of acting or not acting, right? They're sometimes irritated,
mm-hmm.
because they're not getting what they want, because they want me to help them stay attentive to something because they're not able to do it. So if I'm not engaging their attention, then that's a problem. You know, I heard an interesting thing from an NLP point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my trainees was an NLP trainer, and she came up to me and she said, you do everything. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you have a good speaking voice and you tell stories for the auditory people, and for the visual people you have to give handouts and you write things on the chart all the time, and for the kinesthetic you keep them engaged. And I said, I don't understand that one. And she said, kinesthetic learners need to be entertained. And if you don't entertain them, they get bored and they start entertaining themselves.
Oh, that's interesting.
So when a child is, the minute I heard that, I thought of three students in one of my programs in Australia, and I went, I know how to deal with them now. I need to keep them entertained. And not by telling jokes, I can do that too, but not by telling jokes, but by keeping them interested in something, right? And they have a high demand to be entertained, right? Whereas other people can be entertained at other levels. So when I think of someone's boredom, I have to look at the individual,
mm-hmm.
and not as a general thing, and then think, well, what do they need right now that can engage them?
So boredom is really about attention and focus?
I think so.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just find the world such a fascinating place that it's like there's always something to be interested in and misunderstand or understand or figure out.
It made me think of what you asked me before about the book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the book is called Creating Creativity, Embodying the Creative Process. And I got the idea for it, oddly enough, in 1983 when I graduated from my Feldenkrais training, but it was originally about acting in Feldenkrais. And it was, I don't know, 10 or 15 years before I started to write something. And what my first idea was to define creativity, which I quickly found was antithetical to the idea of creativity. I was like, well, no, that's not what I need to do here. And like I said before, most definitions are from the observer's point of view anyway, not from the experiencer's point of view. Like if you look in the dictionary, what's sitting? Sitting is resting upon your buttocks and thighs. But you tell a kid who can't sit that, it doesn't help them. It's a complex act. And so when I started working on a book, I started thinking, well, what are some of the fundamental ideas that are going on in the creative process? And then I thought, well, can I give people the experience of those ideas? And so that's a whole different kind of learning,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm interested in the cognitive learning, right, and that kind of pedagogy, but it's only as useful as one can know the experience of it. And I think my own personal experiences, as I've explored, not just in creativity, but in other domains as well, explored concepts through movement, taking abstract ideas and looking for the experience of them, I've come to a deeper understanding, one where I could argue more for and against it than I could have before, right?
Can you expound on that?
Well, I'll describe one of the lessons in the book,
okay?
And it's one where I'm looking at, you know, I was talking before about emotions and context, so it's really investigating this. So I talked about it, right? And so it may be an interesting concept, and you go, yeah, that's cool, I like that idea, but how do we experience it? So I have people lying on the floor, and I say, lie on your right side and then roll onto your back. I have them do it several times. What do you notice? And then I'll ask, what does it feel like? And people will say different things. And finally, someone usually says, like rolling over in bed. Right? If they don't say it, I'll bring that into it. I say, okay, so now imagine you're rolling over in bed. Already, there's a context and it's different. And by the way, what I'm describing is a quasi-Feldenkrais lesson.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that I created, and I've created many Feldenkrais lessons, but I call it quasi because I'm adding a context to it.
So it's not outside of
context. But it's an experience of where we can experience different ways of knowing ourselves. And so now roll over as if you're in bed. And they do that. Now roll over as if you're turning off the alarm clock. And I'll tell you, everyone slows down and starts dragging. And I say, now roll over and you're turning off the alarm clock and it's set 3 hours earlier than usual. And, oh, my God, they're like sloths, you know. They're barely moving. And then they turn it off and they go right back to bed. And I said, now roll over, turning off the alarm clock set 3 hours early because you're going on a great vacation. And people, boom, they're standing up all of a sudden, you know. So the context changes completely. And then I work with turning it off so you don't wake your partner up, turning it off, not waking your partner after you've had a fight. And then, of course, I ask, whose fault was the fight? And it's different if it was your fault, if it was their fault, you know? And so at the end, when they just roll over, it's a much deeper and a much richer experience because they've broadened it. We've added more context, but that's created more experiences of that simple act of rolling over. And so people can start to understand something about how a context and their emotions are related. So that's a real concrete way of exploring that idea. Does that help?
Yes. Very helpful.
So I'm looking at the clock and I'm realizing that we probably need to start winding down here, although we could get a lot deeper than what. So I have a couple of things, one of which is what I'm really curious about is you've created an amazing life exploring this stuff. And can you tell me a little bit about what that process is and what that life is?
What my life is?
Well, you travel a lot teaching,
yeah.
You write, you...
Yeah.
So I travel about 6 months of the year. And people used to say to me, do you like it? And I used to say, yeah. And then after a while, I'd say, well, I created it. And I say that because, you know, my livelihood is attached to it, too, although I don't have as big a private practice as I used to, but I've given it over to more traveling and training people to become practitioners. But my life's pretty good, actually. I mean, the places I go to over and over again, because Feldenkrais training is 4 years long, and it meets 40 days a year. So right now I have a program in Santa Fe, one in Colombia, one in Sweden. So like in Colombia and Sweden, I go for 2 weeks to a month at a time. And I'm at the same place, and I'm with the same students. So it's kind of like I have these different homes in different places. And, of course, that allows me a lot of other time to do other things as well. And I've actually, you know, I wrote this book on creativity years ago, and since then I've started two other books. And one was Uncommon Sensing, which was about liking ourselves more and self-image. But I sort of put that aside and started another one on kindness, the act, and how we can act more kindly to ourselves and others. But, again, I've been so busy that it's not been in the foreground. One thing I do every year, pretty much every year, is I record a public workshop, and I sell those CDs so people can have a lot of experiences of Feldenkrais, and they're different titles like The Pleasure of Challenge and The Challenge of Pleasure, Uncommon Sensing. There's one for Creating Creativity, Falling. The one I just recorded, I'm pretty proud of. It's not out yet. It's called A Basic Understanding of How You Do Everything You Do. Almost. The almost has to be in there, too, you know. And so most of my life is training people to be Feldenkrais practitioners and really helping people like themselves more.
So what is it? So you keep mentioning training people to be a Feldenkrais practitioner, and just can you talk about that process? Because I know this is a really different process for a lot of people. I love it. It's really fascinating. I found that going to even the preliminary classes for Feldenkrais training really changed my life, my awareness. Not only do I get to like myself more, but I get to know myself more, which is a really important part of that, which is really interesting effect to have from lying there on the floor rolling around and interlacing your toes. You know, it's like, how does that work?
So you know, there's the level of engaging in the Feldenkrais method, just seeing someone privately, and people often come with a pain or difficulty, but often continue because they like it, find it interesting. Then there's classes, and there's weekend workshops and things like that. And, of course, the training program is a much bigger commitment. And the people who do a training program are actually of two groups. One is professionals who want to do this professionally. So sometimes they're massage therapists, physical therapists, people from all walks of life who want to change in career, and this is something that they want to engage in. But then there's a lot of people that do it just for their own personal development. And a training, as I said, it meets 40 days a year over 4 years, and there's different formats for that. And people are learning to go much more deeply, like you were talking about, because like in a training program in the beginning, we're probably doing three awareness through movement lessons a day, plus some touching exercises, some cognitive stuff, and so it's quite a big. I mean, it's full time. You know, it's a whole day thing, and that's a lot to practice oneself, if I could put it that way. You're practicing yourself. You know, you're getting to know yourself in a very, very different way, and the immersion of it, like my training in Santa Fe, which is still open for enrollment, if anyone's interested. You can go, what's the website, www.feldenkraisinsantafe.com. Or you can just email me at alan@feldenkraisinsantafe, and I'll send you information. That process of immersion is one that really makes a difference. And I've had trainings with many different formats, weekend formats, and I prefer the immersion one at this point. I find that people go deeper, and they learn more and come out of it more fulfilled.
So to sort of wind up here, what is there anything you want to say, any transitional, any ultimate pearls of wisdom?
Well,
That's like pearls of wisdom. That's like sometimes I'll say something and someone is writing it down and say, say that again, that was great, and I don't know what I said.
Right.
You know, I'm just talking. So I would just offer that if anyone's interested in the Feldenkrais method, they can contact me. Okay? I have three websites, but probably the one for all purposes now, I mentioned one, but the other that's more useful is called uncommonsensing.com, and there's a lot of free material there you can download, articles that I've written, free podcasts, and free awareness and movement lessons. And actually, if you go to that site, you can subscribe and get a free awareness and movement lesson every month for free. So you can just do that. And if you have questions about it, just send me an email. That email address is Alan, A-L-A-N, at uncommonsensing.com. And
So where can they get your book?
Oh, my book is online. It's PDF, okay? And that's at the website also, along with there's 11 different CD sets. And there's also a DVD that I sell, but it's called Pregnant Pauses. It's for pregnant women. And that's a special program for women to help them be more comfortable throughout their pregnancy. And that website is www.pregnantpauses.us. And I guess I want to thank you for talking with me for this time. I really had a good time, and I hope everyone who's listening finds it useful and generates some thinking for them in a way that moves them to act somewhat differently in their lives.
Thank you very much, Alan. I really appreciate it. It's really nice to have a conversation about this stuff that I've only ever experienced with you. So that's really interesting. It's very interesting for me after 40 years, too. Has that been that long? 35 years, something? 30-some-odd. So long time.
It can't be more.
30 years.
30 years.
30 years. Okay. Yeah, 30 years. Yeah, we were not that old.
10 years old.
So it's really interesting to really have a conversation about it. So I want to thank you again. It's really inspiring, and someday when I retire, I'll go do a Feldenkrais training. It's a little hard to go from Feldenkrais to networking in one day. And I have a little bit of business to take care of here, so I want to tell you that the next show is Mark My Words, Certified Life and Business Coach, Mark Shaw. Episode details to be announced. That's really exciting. Thank you so much for listening to Blog Talk Radio. I'll be talking again in 2 weeks with someone almost as interesting as Alan. And thank you so much, Alan, for coming to talk to me.